Good morning. The first set of readings starts at Genesis 42, verse 1, and it's on page 35 of Church Bibles, Genesis 42, reading verses 1 to 28, and then some verses from chapter 43. So starting at verse 1 of chapter 42, when Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, "You are spies, you have come to see the nakedness of the land." They said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." He said to them, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die." And they did so. Then they said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. He said to his brothers, "My money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack." At this, their hearts failed them, and they turned, trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" Then chapter 43, verses 1 and 2. Now the famine was severe in the land, and when they had eaten the grain that they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, "Go again, buy us a little food." And then again from verse 12 to the end of the chapter. "Take double the money with you. Carry back with you the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take also your brother and arise. Go again to the man. May God Almighty grant you mercy before the man. And may he send back your other brother and Benjamin. And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." So the men took this present, and they took double the money with them, and Benjamin. They arose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, "Bring the men into the house and slaughter an animal and make ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon." The man did as Joseph told him and brought the men to Joseph's house. And the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house. And they said, "It is because of the money which was replaced in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may assault us and fall upon us to make us servants and seize our donkeys." So they went up to the steward of Joseph's house and spoke with him at the door of the house and said, "O my lord, we came down the first time to buy food. And when we came to the lodging place, we opened our sacks, and there was each man's money in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. So we have brought it again with us, and we have brought other money down with us to buy food. We do not know who put our money in our sacks." He replied, "Peace to you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has put treasure in your sacks for you. I received your money." Then he brought Simeon out to them. And when the man had brought the men into Joseph's house and given them water, and they had washed their feet, and when they had given their donkeys fodder, they prepared the present for Joseph's coming at noon, for they heard that they should eat bread there. When Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present that they had with them and bowed down to him to the ground. And he inquired about their welfare and said, "Is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" They said, "Your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive." And they bowed their heads and prostrated themselves. And he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, "Is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? God be gracious to you, my son." Then Joseph hurried out, for his compassion grew warm for his brother, and he sought a place to weep, and he entered his chamber and wept there. Then he washed his face and came out, and controlling himself, he said, "Serve the food." They served him by himself and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked at one another in amazement. Portions were taken to them from Joseph's table, but Benjamin's portion was 5 times as much as any of theirs. And they drank and were merry with him.
Good morning. We're now going to read the second two chunks of the verses that Roger's going to preach for us this morning. And if you've closed your Black Church Bible, you'll find those beginning on page 38. And we're going to start from chapter 44, verse 1. So chapter 44, verse 1. "Then he commanded the steward of his house, 'Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. And put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, with his money for the grain.' And he did as Joseph told him. As soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys. They had gone only a short distance from the city. Now Joseph said to his steward, 'Up, follow after the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is it not from this that my Lord drinks, and by this that he practices divination? You have done evil in doing this.' When he overtook them, he spoke to them these words, and they said to him, 'Why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money that we found in the mouths of our sacks, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from our Lord's house? Whichever of your servants is found with it shall die, and we also will be my Lord's servants.' He said, 'Let it be as you say. He who is found with it shall be my servant, and the rest of you shall be innocent.' Then each man quickly lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack. And he searched, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there. They fell before him to the ground. Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination?" And Judah said, "What shall we say to my lord? What shall we speak? Or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my lord's servants, both we and he also, in whose hand the cup has been found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my servant. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." Then Judah went up to him and said, "O my lord, please let your servant speak a word in my lord's ear. And let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself." And we're now going to move ahead and start from chapter 44, verse 33. "Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father." Then Joseph could not control himself before all those that stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me. And you and your children and your children's children and your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here.' Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and went upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him."
Thank you all for what was a longer reading than usual. And we've got a longer passage than usual. We're looking at all of chapters 42 to 45 of Genesis this morning. And we're also going to look at them next week. We're going to have two bites at this section. And we do have quite an adventure in store. This is an amazing section right in the middle of the last section of the book, this final block of Genesis. And this is right at the heart of the final act. And it is a deeply dramatic section. This is the moment where Joseph is reunited with his brothers. It's also a deeply moving section. That last stuff that Chris was reading there, extraordinary, actually, what Joseph ends up doing with his brothers. But although there's a lot of wonderful stuff to come, we may be feeling a bit daunted as we set off this morning, partly because there's four chapters. I mean, four. In fact, it's five, isn't it? Five chapters. And some of the action is confusing. So Joseph seems to be doing stuff which is strange. He He so far has been the hero of the story in Genesis, but when he recognizes his brothers, he keeps on a kind of Egyptian disguise so that they can't recognize him. And then he seems to give them the runaround, like framing Benjamin with sticking a cup in his sack and then chasing after him. So what's kind of going on? Is he sticking it to his brothers? Is this him getting his own back? Is he so scrambled by what's happened in the past, the trauma and the emotion of it, that he just doesn't know what to do, doesn't really know what he's doing? Is this the section where Joseph goes rogue? No, that's not it. There's actually a clear answer to what is going on, because Joseph, we're going to see, is putting his family back together. It's the thing that's blown my mind and increasingly blown my heart as I've been preparing. Joseph is putting his family back together. So let me pray for God's help to understand his word as we begin. Our Father in heaven, we thank you that wherever else is on our minds and hearts this morning, that what you have to say to us is good for us. And so we pray that you would open our ears and soften our hearts to hear your voice and be changed by you. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, if you're new to Christian things, I realize all the names and events in that reading might all sound pretty strange and don't know what's going on. Let me begin slightly further back. If you are new to Christian things, you may be asking the question, what evidence is there that Jesus is someone to be taken seriously? So I know that all these people here think Jesus is amazing and the center of life, but is there actually any proof? Now, there's one whole body of proof, which is what Jesus did when he was on earth. And in our evening series in Matthew, we're covering that at the moment. What did the eyewitnesses actually see this man do? That's one whole body of proof. But there's another whole kind of section of evidence, which is what happened before Jesus arrived. So God didn't just vindicate him, give kind of his backing with miracles and things when Jesus was walking around. God also prepared the way for Jesus through the Old Testament for hundreds of years in different times and places. God prepared pictures and promises of Jesus, the King, to come. And Genesis has had some of those promises, and now we're getting some of those pictures of Jesus, the King, to come. In fact, this whole section, this chapters 37 to 50, is about the King, the Book of the King. That's what we've been calling it. However, across our small groups, some brilliant questions have been popping up. So just before we get into our chapter, or chapters, I thought I'd do a quick FAQ, frequently asked questions. There is an outline, by the way, a much fuller outline with pictures to keep us awake through lots of material. But there's no pictures in the FAQ, sorry about that. But three questions, just briefly to tackle on. Firstly, someone asked, why do we keep talking about king? Because Joseph isn't even called a king, is he? Good observation. Yes, he's not called a king. That's exactly right. And yet, he's described in king-like terms over and over and over again. So the very first dream he has, he rises up and everyone gathers and bows down. That's a kind of king image. And the brothers who heard him say that dream, they get the point. They say to him in chapter 37, would you reign over us? Would you rule over us? Those are king words. In fact, that pair of words is only found elsewhere in the Bible around a king, rule and reign. Likewise, Joseph rises up to be a kind of prince ruler of Egypt. And in our passage, if you look at chapter 45 and verse 8, it is described in pretty high terms. 45 verse 8, he says, so it was not you, 45 verse 8 on page 39, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He's made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. So he does kind of sound like a king, but the K word is not used of him. Interesting. I think that's very deliberate. So I'm going to have various pictures to keep us going. Liam, hopefully they'll... thank you. They'll appear. So there's Joseph. Very deliberately, he's the shape of a king whilst not being called a king. Why is that? Because the Bible is preparing for the big king, the big J king, Jesus. Okay. And actually, next week, we're looking at Joseph today in these central chapters. Next week, we're going to look at Judah, who's a second picture of the king in this section, again, pointing to Jesus. And the fact you've got two of them shows, probably they're not the ultimate king. Neither get the K word, because Jesus is the ultimate king. Hope that makes sense. And we are looking for kings with a capital K, because God has promised Abraham, kings are going to come from your line. Sarah, kings are going to come from your line. Jacob, kings are going to come from your line. And these guys are almost the king, a picture of the king. But it brings us to FAQ 2b. Why do we keep saying Joseph is a picture or a type, we're using that word type, of Jesus, which is like a pattern of Jesus? The New Testament doesn't say he's a type of Jesus, does it? Well, I used to think that it didn't. I remember sitting in a church listening to a series on Genesis and thinking, oh, I would never preach that Joseph was a picture of Jesus because the New Testament doesn't say it. How wrong I was. So Acts 7, the first speech that ever got a Christian killed, Stephen, you don't have to look it up now, you can look up later, the references are on the sheet, but Stephen starts with Joseph and how his brothers treated him, and then goes all the way along through Moses to get to Jesus and how people were treating Jesus. He compares the two and says, you know what happened with Joseph and his brothers? That's what's happened with Jesus when he turned up. It's a similar pattern. But actually, it's not even Stephen, just Stephen in Acts 7. Jesus himself, this was new to me, Jesus himself, when he does the parable of the tenants, when he says that God plants a vineyard and gives it to people, and then he sends his son to them, thinking that they'll listen to the son. And what those tenants do, this is Matthew 21, if you want to look up later, what the tenants do is they see him far off, like the brothers did in Genesis 37, and they say to each other, come, let us kill him, which is what the brothers did in Genesis 37. As in, Jesus himself said, you know what happened in Genesis 37 about Joseph? Well, that's what's happening to me, because like Joseph, I'm God's promised ruler. So Jesus does make the connection. Final one, though, someone raised the puzzle of surely Joseph can't be a picture of Jesus, because in some ways he doesn't look like Jesus, like he's human, not God, and when he goes down, he doesn't go all the way to death, and he doesn't rise from the dead, so why are we saying that's a bit like Jesus? And in our passage particularly, he's pretending, like he's doing some slightly dodgy stuff, he's putting on a disguise, he's saying some things that aren't true to keep up the pretense, the divination stuff is just, it's just not true, he's just playing the role. How can that be a picture of Jesus? And the important thing to realize about types or pictures of Jesus is all of them are a bit like Jesus and a bit not like Jesus, which I think we kind of know. So here's one from we had from Hebrews. An animal sacrifice all the way through the Old Testament. These lambs kept on swapping in for God's people. And that was a picture of Jesus. Hebrews 10 called them a type or a shadow of Jesus. And the thing with an animal sacrifice is it's clearly not Jesus, is it? He's not a lamb. He doesn't have a fur coat. Do they have fur? Wool coat. But he is like a lamb in that he takes the place of the people, his death on the cross. Does that make sense? So it's always like and unlike him. Okay, that's enough of that. All of that hopefully gives us some enthusiasm and willingness to look through now and remind ourselves of how Joseph has been a picture of Jesus. So one more bit of recap before we get into our chapters. Very helpfully, last week, Robin used this diagram, a kind of down and up is the shape of Joseph's life, down and up. And I'm just going to fill in what we've seen in the chapters so far on that picture. So in chapter 37, Joseph, like Jesus, is the wrongly rejected ruler. He's chosen by God as the ruler. That's announced in the dreams. His brothers say no, chuck him in a pit, and then sell him into slavery, hand him over to the Gentiles. That's 37. 39, in Egypt now, as a slave, he's the falsely convicted ruler. So he's wrongly accused of a crime he didn't commit. He's perfectly innocent, but again, he's rejected. Thrown into a second pit, this time it's prison, and that's by Egypt. Chapter 40, getting into last week now. Chapter 40, he's stuck in the pit. Kind of hopelessly defeated, it seems. Looks like there's no hope. And then, chapter 41, second half of last week, he's the remarkably raised ruler. As in, he goes from rock bottom, stuck in the pit, to right up top, palace, from pit to palace, or from prisoner to prince of Egypt. Which brings us to where we've got to. That's the end of chapter 41. So what happens next? That's the question. Well, to put it another way, when God's chosen ruler is sitting on the throne, like has the power, what's he going to do? Up till now, he's been opposed and defeated, seemingly, and kind of pushed to the side. But when he has the power, when Joseph is on top, what's he going to do? And the next few weeks are going to be wonderful, because what he does is save people. That's what he does. When God's king has all the power and authority, he uses that power and authority to save people. He operates from a throne of grace. Now, we started to see that last week. If you just look at the end of chapter 41 last week, page 35, I know it's warm, but I think flicking will help blow some air around, so flick the pages and keep going with me. Chapter 41, page 35, I'll pick it up from verse 55, chapter 41, verse 55. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, what he says to you, do. And then verse 57, moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. So I put some salvation life rings up there, which are pictures of Joseph's salvation, which is a picture of Jesus. And the first, they kind of cover different groups. So the first one that I've just read is the world. That covers the world, the end of chapter 41. The second one, which is our one for this morning, is the brothers. That's 42 to 45, the brothers. And then the third one, in a couple of weeks' time with Jay, the promises. This is the king who brings about the promises. I hope that makes some sense. So we're in with the brothers today. How does King Jesus, or King Joseph, extend salvation to his family? Okay, let's dive in. That's page one done, so we're storming. Page two, which is our actual points. We've got 2 points this morning, but if it's too hot even to remember 2 points, just remember the title at the very top. Just look at that title. God's ruler is fixing a family, not just a famine. That's the basic point this morning. God's ruler is fixing a family, not just a famine. And basically, that's our 2 points. We're going to look at the famine first from point one, and then the family from point two. So let's get into it. This family is famished, but God put Joseph in place to generously provide for them. Now, if you look at 42 verses 1 to 5, it's very clear that the family are in trouble. They're famished. I'll pick it up. When Jacob learned, verse 1, that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I've heard that there's grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there that we may live and not die." And so they went off to buy grain. There's no doubt the situation here is serious. Verse 5 talks about the famine being in the land of Canaan. It's all over this region. And Jacob's explicit, this is a life or death matter. Now, I think we struggle to understand this, not living in a subsistence culture, living directly from the land. There are many places globally still today that a mass failure of crops, like an awful drought or other catastrophic famine conditions, it doesn't just mean that your veg is going to be slightly more expensive at Tesco's. This is life and death here. And we know from Pharaoh's dreams last night, this is going to be 7 years of that. It's not an exaggeration to say the whole future of God's promised family, therefore the whole future of God's promises, hangs on whether they can get any food. And so they set off for Egypt. Now, how do we know that they succeed? Well, turn across to verse 25 of chapter 42. Verse 25 of chapter 42. And what we discover is that it's Joseph, is God's king, who provides. So verse 25 of chapter 42, Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. And they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. So what actually happens is they set off empty-handed. Well, they got money, but they set off with no food. They come back with loads of food, and they keep their money. That's what actually happens in this famine crisis. Now, they're worried about that. They're like, oh, dear, something's gone wrong. There's been an admin error in your favor. Collect £200. They are kind of wondering what's going on here. In fact, verse 28, they ask this worried question, verse 28 of chapter 42. He said to his brothers, my money's been put back. Here it is at the mouth of my sack. At this, their hearts failed them. They turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? Now, they don't know what's going on at this point. But what God, the actual answer to that question, what God has done for them is provide. That's what he's done. They had famine. He's provided feast. Here's your grain, full to overflowing, and your money back. Free provision. How? Through his king. God's chosen king is providing for his family. Now, the brothers are shaken by that, and we'll understand more of that in a little bit. But that pattern of starting starving and ending up feasting, it then happens all over again. So on the handout, I've done a little table. There's actually two journeys here. That's why it's such a long passage. There are two journeys. There's journey one, which is chapter 42, and journey two, which is chapters 43 to 45. And the two journeys look similar to each other. That's the point. They both begin with famine. So chapter 43 now, second journey, begins the same way. 43 verse 1. Now the famine was severe in the land, and when they'd eaten the grain they brought from Egypt, they've run out. So their father said to them, go again, buy us a little food. Same thing, same problem. Death is coming if we don't get some food. And so they set off, although they're pretty worried this time when they set off. The brothers are worried because they're thinking, oh, what about that money? Are they going to think we nicked it? The dad's worried, Jacob, because he's this time has to send Benjamin. And he doesn't really trust sending Benjamin with these brothers. He knows what happened with Joseph. Everyone's feeling worried. In fact, if you look at verse 18 of chapter 43, we get exactly what their worry was. The men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house. He says, come dine with me. Let's have lunch. And they think this is what's going to happen. It's because of the money, which was replaced in our sacks the first time that we were brought in. So he may assault us and fall upon us to make us servants and seize our donkeys. That's what they're worried is going to happen. What actually happens, well, when they meet Joseph's steward, they in verse 19, they tumble out all their excuses. And look what he says, verse 23. He replied, peace to you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has put treasure in your sacks for you. So actually, what God is doing, they have that question, what's God doing to us? What God's doing is providing for them richly the grain and the money. And then Joseph turns up. And again, they're all kind of getting ready with their special gift to him. But what actually happens is he provides for them. So look down just at the end, verse 34 of chapter 43. Portions were taken to them from Joseph's table. They drank and were merry with him. Now, I'm skipping over some bits there, you'll see, but we'll come back to those. But at the moment, the simple storyline happens twice. Twice, they're starving and they are going to die. Twice, they set off to Egypt to get grain. Twice, Joseph provides the feast. God provides through his king that he's put in place. And actually, that's exactly the lesson that Joseph draws out. So jump now right to the end, chapter 45. Sorry about all the turning, but chapter 45, verse 4. This is when Joseph has finally taken off his disguise and told them who he is. And verse 4, he says, come near to me, please. And they came near, and he said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine's been in the land these 2 years, and then yet 5 years in which there'll be neither ploughing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, to keep alive for you many survivors. It was not you who sent me here, but God. Do you get the point? I love it when it says it three times. God sent me here. God put the king in place to save lives. So let me put up a picture in case you've been drifting. Point one, from famine to feast. How? God put the king there. God put the king there who saves Jesus. Joseph, that's not deliberate. Joseph, the ruler, God's chosen ruler, who he raises up, puts on the throne to save people. And in fact, it's an amazing salvation. If you look at verse 21, he absolutely showers them with gifts once he's taken the disguise off. The sons of Israel did say, verse 21 of chapter 45, Joseph gave them wagons, according to the command of Pharaoh, gave them provisions for the journey. To each and all of them, he gave a change of clothes. But to Benjamin, he gave 300 shekels of silver, 5 changes of clothes. To his father, he sent as follows, 10 donkeys. You know what they were worried about? He's going to steal our donkeys. They end up with loads of donkeys, like 10 male ones and some female ones to come, loaded with good things of Egypt, loaded with grain, bread, provision for his father for the journey. Then he sent his brothers away. It is a lavish provision. It reminded me, you know, when loving parents send kids off to university, and they're like, you should have a sandwich for the way, and I should give you some extra clothing. Have you got socks, underpants, clean? Do you need a lamp? We've got a lamp we don't use. You could have a lamp. Why don't you borrow the car so you can take all this stuff with you? It's that kind of generosity out of real love. Okay, that's the first point. This family's famished, but God put Joseph in place to generously provide for them. So far, so simple. And actually, that in itself is wonderful. Remember, this is a picture of Jesus. And what we're seeing about Jesus from this first point is that he alone can provide life in the face of death. There's this impending problem coming towards the family, and only the king can provide. God put the king in place to save them. Or Joseph isn't quite the king, he's the governor, but Jesus is the big king that he points to. Jesus, who went a lot further down than Joseph, not just to the pit of the prison, but all the way into the grave, and then rose a lot further up than Joseph, sitting on the throne at God's right hand, who opens the storehouses and says, I can give you life. Come to me, I can give you life. So that's one thing that this section is doing. But actually, you could tell that story really quickly. So you could just do that story in a few verses. Brothers are hungry, head to Egypt. Joseph provides grain, brothers come home, and then we do it again. And then you're done. I mean, that would be very quick, much shorter sermon. But actually, if you've read these passages before, or if you were listening during the reading, there's a lot more complexity going on, isn't there? Like, that's the basic outline, that they need food and Joseph provides food. But there's so much shenanigans in the middle. There's so many things going on, extra complexities, spanners that Joseph seems to be throwing in the works. And we need to understand what is going on there. And basically what's going on is our second point. See, this family has two problems, actually. One problem is the famine issue. They're famished. But in many ways, a deeper and more serious problem even than that is that the family is fractured. This family is deeply fractured. If you've been around Genesis, I don't need to spend long persuading us of that, I hope. 11 of the boys tried to kill one of them, and then sold him into slavery. They lied to their dad. Their dad doesn't trust his sons enough to even send Benjamin, the youngest, with them. It's a complete mess. There's envy, rivalry, favoritism. And actually, it's not just this generation of the family that's a mess. All the way through Genesis, it's been a mess. Just think of some of the brothers we've met. Cain killed Abel. Ishmael had a go at Isaac. Had to be separated. Jacob was under a threat of life from Esau, wanted to kill him. And now this generation. That is a problem for God's promises, because the big promise is that God's going to work through this family to be a united nation that will bless the other nations. But they can't even hold themselves together for 3 generations. At which point, in steps Joseph. See, across these 2 journeys with the brothers, Joseph doesn't just feed them, he brings them graciously to conviction of sin and then reconciliation. Reconciliation with each other and with him and with God, most importantly. Again, I've done a little table, because we're not going to be able to go through all the detail. I've done a little table kind of summarizing the main plot events that we need to spot. So let's go back to chapter 42, first off. Chapter 42, we're going to have another run through, this time looking at the bits where Joseph is working on their heart issues, not just their stomachs, but their souls. So in 42 verse 11, they say that they are honest men. That's that kind of starting position. We are honest men. Joseph is saying, you're spies. And they're saying, no, we're honest men. Now, Joseph knows they're not spies. He also knows they're not honest men. And the tests that will come are designed to see if they're honest men or if they'll admit to themselves and to God what they've actually done. So let's jump down to verse 18 of chapter 42. Verse 18. On the third day, first he throws them all in prison for a few days, either to give them time to think about stuff or to give him time to make the plans. But on the third day, verse 18, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you'll live, for I fear God." There's a clue that he's not gone rogue. "If you're honest men," there's the test, "let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households. And bring your youngest brother, that's Benjamin, to me. So your words will be verified, and you shall not die." Now, what's going on here? Contrary to what people sometimes say, or you may read, Joseph is not just taking out his anger on them. If he wanted to do that, I mean, he's in complete control. He could just have them killed, or have them imprisoned completely forever. He certainly wouldn't send them back with grain and money. So it's not just he's lost it and he's angry. I don't even think it's that he's confused and kind of flailing around, just no idea what he's doing. Because when you look closely, there is a careful plan going on. This is the bit to concentrate on if you've drifted. Careful plan. He is designing a scenario that looks the same as what happened with him back in chapter 37. So he imprisons one son, Simeon, in Egypt, and says the others can go free. More than that, he gives them money, puts money in the sack. Now, when was the last time they went back to their father, minus a brother, with a pile of money? When they sold Joseph into slavery, into Egypt. He's recreating the scenario, do you see? And actually, it does have the impact of starting to bring conviction to them. I don't know if there's anything in your life, that any situation where you just wish you could go back and do it again, do it differently, because many of us have things like that, something we said or something we did. Perhaps that's the kind of thing you try never to think about. Just try and bury it in the past. I'm not going to talk to others about it. I'm definitely not talking to God about it. I'm just going to pretend it's not there. But Joseph knows that if there's going to be real reconciliation, we can't just pretend it's not there. You need to be honest, men, he's saying to them. And so he recreates this scenario, and verse 21, they start to come to their senses. They start to come to a conviction of guilt. Verse 21, they said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother." Not their brother Simeon, not him at all, but their brother Joseph, do you see? In that, and this is, suddenly we get an insight into what it was like that day, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. Reuben said, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? You wouldn't listen. So now comes a reckoning." Now Joseph is listening all to this. He can understand it, even though he's pretending to be Egyptian. He can obviously understand Hebrew. And he breaks down in tears. Because he cares about them. He's disguising himself as this tough Egyptian ruler, but actually he loves these brothers. He wants to put them back together. He has compassion on his family. What a ruler he is. Despite their terrible treatment of him, he's deeply moved to see them come to this realization. Okay, that's the first journey. And if we're right on that, then the second journey will have some of the same kind of outlines, and of course it does, exactly the same. Last time it was journey one, it was Simeon who gets locked up. This time it's Benjamin Joseph's going to pull the strings to make sure Benjamin is isolated and the rest can go free. Interesting though, he takes a run-up. So all the come dine with me stuff, come and have lunch with me, is a run-up to the Benjamin issue, because he's reminding the brothers of favoritism. So Benjamin gets an extra portion, well, in fact, five extra portions. Have you ever been at dinner with brothers? I mean, everyone wants the best portion. And then Benjamin gets five, the five best, and then the trickle down to everyone else. He's like stirring the pot, saying, hey, this is a bit like when our dad favored me, isn't it? And then, chapter 40, that's 43, then chapter 44, he frames Benjamin. So he sticks the cup in Benjamin's sack, chases after them with his steward. And we can be sure what Joseph's plan is, because it almost goes horribly wrong. Just have a look at verse 9. So here, chapter 44, verse 9, here the steward is caught up with him, and he's saying, look, he accuses them that someone's taken the cup, and they go over the top in their kind of, if this is true of us, then look what they say is going to happen. Verse 9, they say, whichever of your servants is found with the cup shall die, and we also will be my Lord's servants. Now that's like way beyond what Joseph wants to do in his test. And so the steward has to do this brilliant bit of diplomacy. I love this. Listen to this. He said, verse 10, let it be as you say, and then just completely different plan. So look, let it be as you say, he who's found with it, they said die, he says shall be my servant, and the rest of you can go free. Do you see, Joseph is trying to recreate the same scenario. One brother isolated, imprisoned in Egypt, the rest can just go free. That's what he's trying to do. It happens again, actually. Judah again says, we'll all be enslaved. And Joseph says, no, one brother, the rest can go free. The point being, he's convicting them about the previous situation. He's bringing them to an awareness of their guilt. And it works again. So Judah, look at verse 16. It's very striking. When Benjamin is caught and they're all brought back, verse 16, Judah's words are very striking. Judah said, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? How can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also in whose hand the cup has been found. Striking that. I mean, he's admitting their guilt, but they're not guilty for the cup. But they are coming to realize how guilty they are for Joseph, for rejecting God's chosen ruler. And Judah says a lot more, which we'll look at next week. But basically, that's the point, 45 verse 1, when Joseph can't keep up the act anymore. Joseph, verse 1, couldn't control himself before all those who stood by him. So he clears the room, and then we come to the emotional heart of the passage. Verse 3, Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Of course they were. And they've just been remembering, just been reminded of how they treated Joseph. And now they've discovered that same guy is in all power over them. The one we thought we could just get rid of and his dreams wouldn't come true is in front of us, and he can do whatever he wants with us. He's in charge. And he knows we're guilty. And look what he does, verse 4. So Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they came near, and he said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. And then by verse 14 and 15, they're falling on each other and weeping and talking. See, Joseph is putting a fractured family back together. That's the second picture, and I think it's the bigger picture, actually. From fractured to... I'll just skip through the drama to get to the conclusion. From fractured to family. I don't know if you've ever thought about the hug emoji in relation to Jesus' kingship. And I realize that might sound like I'm trivializing it. Emojis can do that, but that's not the point. The point is, this is the picture we're given of God's King Jesus, that he falls on their necks and weeps as he embraces them. Here's a king who's not content just to feed people. He wants to bring a family back together. Now, time is nearly gone. If you look over to the back page, I'm very briefly just going to run through the implications of this. And what I'd love us to do in our small groups, we've got a printout, a handout that kind of summarizes the story. I think if we spend all our time trying to fill in the story, we won't have any time to talk about implications in groups. I'd love us instead to kind of listen to this, look at the outline of the story, and spend our time reflecting on these applications, because they're massive, I think. First off, implications for us as we move from Joseph to Jesus. Number one, like Joseph, God's ultimate ruler, Jesus, is lovingly determined to deal with our sin, not just our stomachs. So like in Mark 2, there's this paralyzed man who's lowered through the roof to him. It's very clear that he has a physical need, a massive physical need. And Jesus does go on to heal him, enable him to walk. But actually, Jesus' priority is to deal with his sin, to point out there's a sin issue here. If you want to be reconciled to God, we need to be honest about the issue. That's the first thing. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus puts on an Egyptian disguise and kind of takes us through all these kind of tests, recreates our life. Like, you don't Groundhog Day your life until you realize I've got this wrong. But he is putting his finger on the fact we need to say sorry for stuff. That's the way you become a Christian, actually, realizing I need forgiveness from God through Jesus. That's point one. Point two, like the brothers, if we want to be reconciled to God, we need to be honest about how we've treated his king. So in Luke 18, there's two people. There's a Pharisee who's saying, God, thank you that I'm not that bad because I'm better than other people. That comparative thing, I'm not that bad. Or there's a tax collector who says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus says it's the tax collector that goes home reconciled with God. Because he was honest enough to say there's a problem. Point C, implication three. When we're honest to God about our sin, what do we find? One of the things that struck me in the passage is when the brothers realize who they're dealing with, they hang back. To their shock, they've rejected the one who is above them. And they cower back, they're dismayed. But what does Joseph do and what does Jesus do? Well, he opens his arms wide and says, come to me. So the parable of the prodigal son, that's where that phrase is from, bring quickly the best robe. Jesus told that parable because sinners were drawing near to him and the religious types couldn't cope with it. They're just like, how dare you let those people come near you? Jesus told this story about someone who went completely off the rails, then admitted to God that they'd sinned, and God, pictured as this loving father, opens his arms and welcomes him back, showers him with generosity, bring the best robe. And then finally, and I'd love us to reflect more on this and talk more about this, because I think in some ways this might be the sharp end, this might be the pointiest of all the applications for us as a church family, which is this. If we've realized that Jesus is dealing with our sin, and if we've been honest that we've rejected him, and if we've been welcomed by his loving arms to forgive us, well then that can and should lead to genuine reconciliation with one another. The family of God is often fractured. We're fractured people, but Jesus is putting us back together. And the way we get put back together as a family is by experiencing the grace of the King and extending it to each other. Matthew 18, somebody's asking Jesus, how many times do I have to forgive a Christian if they've blown it again? He tells a story of a servant who was let off a massive debt and then struggled to let a fellow servant off a debt. Should you not have mercy on your fellow servant? Our time is gone. But I hope that's given us enough to chew on in terms of the extraordinary picture of God's King, that he's the one who doesn't just rescue us from death and famine, but from fractured relationships with each other and with God. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we do thank you for this picture of Jesus. Thank you that what he uses his power for as he sits on the throne at your right hand is to offer salvation to people like us. Please help us to gladly approach him, the throne of grace, and extend that grace to one another. In Jesus' name, amen.